Words on Water.
Welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is the host, Travis Loop. PFAS is absolutely the hottest issue in water right now. It's one of the hottest environmental issues in our country and around the world, really. So I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Linda Lee from Purdue University, who knows an awful lot about this topic and also about biosolids, which is an area of interest when it comes to PFAS. Linda, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Travis. Thank you.
Yeah. So just to set the stage a little bit, could you talk about your academic background and kind of the current focus of your work?
Sure. I did my undergraduate. Actually, I did all my degrees at University of Florida because of family situation. But I did my undergraduate in chemistry, and then I did my master's in environmental engineering and my PhD in soil chemistry and contaminant hydrology. So I kind of moved around to the three colleges on the same campus, and I did my master's and PhD. I always tell people while I was doing my postdoc, because I was working full time as an analytical chemist in a fate and transport lab.
So. Okay. And when and why did you start studying this, you know, the PFAS family of compounds?
Actually, I have an interesting response to that. So about 2005 or a little bit before that, DuPont actually approached me and asked if they could come visit me, some people from the polymer division that I didn't really know. And that was because some people in the ag division and in the people that do environmental fate, they knew about me and my lab and my work. So I said, okay. And so they came and they presented their story about PFAS for the chemicals that they produced and what they knew about them. And then they asked me if I would be interested in working on that compound class. And I had said that that because of my work with antibiotics and some other compounds that are a little harder to deal with analytically than your standard legacy compounds, for lack of a simpler term.
Sure.
I said, yes, I would be interested. And I said, what is it that you want that you're interested in? And they said, well, we just want to get some academic groups developing the science to study these compounds because we think there's going to be a lot of work on them. And so they actually gave me a gift, some gift funds that actually launched our research in that and allowed me to buy the instrumentation that I had to have to even do the research. And after that, you know, they didn't have anything to do with what I was doing, except if I needed standards that weren't available yet. That might come up later in our podcast. They provided them. And if they had some insight on analyticals, because at that time, not a lot of people had insight, except for the actual companies like 3M and DuPont that were producing them.
When was this?
That was in, I would say, the 2004-2005 timeframe.
Okay. Yeah, about 15 years ago then.
Yes, and they... I think they knew that there was going to need to be, the science needed to be developed, and it had to be credible science. And as you know, oftentimes people have a lack of trust, sometimes for good reason, sometimes not, on what industry might provide. And so they wanted to see academics come up with the science. And I think at that time, a lot of them didn't really realize that we might not come up with the best results, but that didn't matter.
So you were aware that they were kind of approaching other researchers at other universities to kind of to do science as well, do research?
I wasn't really aware of who they were talking to. They just said that their goal was to get more people doing the science, and they were going to labs that they trusted to do the science to start developing the tools and be able to understand how these compounds would behave in the environment, even how to analyze them. I mean, they're a rough bunch.
Yeah. So what in particular were they interested in you studying, or if they didn't kind of have a particular interest, what did you study and start doing science on?
Okay. They just wanted me to develop the science and start doing research on them. They didn't ask me to focus on anything specific. They just showed me what they had so far Mm-hmm. And I got to go from there.
Okay.
And then after that, you know, obviously submitted grants. I had a National Science Foundation grant to look at these compounds. And initially we were interested in how the different substituents that are in a PFAS compound and how it's associated with other parts of that larger molecule, how that would change how they degrade. So initially we were really interested in basically degradation pathways and, you know, what's the end result. And interesting, now we all hear the term precursors, and that's because PFASs, they can degrade through a very, you know, several pathways, but they degrade to just more PFASs, and everything in between are more PFASs. So all the intermediates are PFASs. So you go from A to Z, and they're both PFASs, and everything in between are PFASs.
This is part of that nickname, Forever Chemicals.
Exactly, because while a lot of them do break down, they break down to the ones that don't go any further. We call them terminal products from microbial degradation. Mm-hmm. And the ones that people are most familiar with, PFOA and PFOS, they are both in the original production line to make other PFASs, and they're also the end product of one of the end products of the PFAS degradation pathway.
So those two are really kind of, and pardon me, I'm not a scientist, but those are kind of the foundational building blocks then, the PFOA and the PFAS.
Well, they're in that initial building block stream mm-hmm. of synthesis, and it can be other, you know, now, you know, you might ask me this later, but now that the longer chains are being phased out, and that has to do with the length of the chain of the PFAS, how big the molecule is, I guess, is a simple way to say. And now, you know, when they're phasing those out, they are trying to work with shorter chain, so smaller PFAS. And the goal there is that they don't accumulate in the body as much. And then the hope is that they're also have less potential for adverse effects. Mm. And it does seem like, you know, it seems like that they have a lower potential for adverse effect at a given concentration, but they still can. It's all about, you know, chemical load. So they can still have similar impacts, but maybe they have to be at higher concentration. Mm-hmm. And since they don't build up in the body as much, then that makes them be more favorable. They're still forever chemicals, mm-hmm. but they're more favorable, I guess.
Sure. On a scale. Yeah, comparatively, right. Sure. Is it how tough PFAS is to degrade and that part of it just kind of stays together? Is that what makes this a particularly challenging family of chemicals when it comes to public health and environmental concerns?
Yeah, that's one part that they are forever chemicals. And the second thing is there's so many of them. There's, you know, we talk about PFAS as this one big family, which it is, but within it is several subfamilies. And that just has slightly different chemistries. But in the end, there's, you know, right now we're approaching close to 5,000 that we say have been produced. Probably only half that might be, you know, actually being used a lot in production. So potentially out in our environment. But as we phase out some that we've already talked about, new ones are being made. And they're alternatives, but they're still PFAS. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, alternatives do not mean not PFAS. They just mean other kinds of perfluorinated or polyfluorinated chemicals that have less likelihood to bioaccumulate in our body, require much higher concentrations to be toxic. Because in reality, everything can be toxic, even water, we joke, if you have too much too fast. Okay.
Right.
So that's one challenge. That's two challenges. The number of them, the fact that even the ones that degrade to PFASs that don't degrade, they require advanced instrumentation to quantify, which not that many labs have that capability, although that's growing. And then there's only standards for, you know, probably 40, 45, mm-hmm. and there's, you know, several thousand. So you can't actually quantify a lot of them. So you can't find them in even the traditional advanced instrumentation. So that requires you having even more advanced instrumentation that only a few labs actually have in the United States, really globally on a percent scale, that allows you to look for things that we don't have standards for and at least know what do we have, even if we don't know the concentration. So those are all things that make them hard to, you know, make them difficult. They also don't seem to interact with, so they're persistent, like the PCBs that most people are familiar with. Mm-hmm. But PCBs, we didn't find them in water that often because they're highly sorbed, and they are also bioaccumulative, meaning highly sorbed to soil and particles, so they don't travel with water very fast. However, these PFASs, they're as persistent as PCBs, but they're also very water soluble on a relative scale. So, you know, the larger PFASs might not be in water, but then as they degrade to all these other ones that we normally look for, those are going to, you know, show up in water. And they also appear to be unique in how they move through soil profiles, because it's not just about what's happening in the water and in the soil. It also has to do with interfaces in like the zone where you would grow crops in. You know, we know there has to be air there, or the soil, you know, crops aren't going to be healthy. They're flooded. Well, PFASs do weird things at the air-water interfaces that actually, in a good way, they don't transport, we don't think, as far as, you know, they don't transport as fast as we would have thought based on traditional approaches. So that could be good, but it also means they're going to be hanging out there for a long time.
Okay. One of the reasons I tracked you down for this podcast is because you published some research of yours was published in the Water Environment Research Journal that WEF puts out, kind of related to biosolids and so forth. So let's kind of move in that direction. Before biosolids are produced, you know, as part of the water treatment process, what do we know, what do you know about what happens to PFAS in the wastewater treatment process?
You know, obviously all these PFASs are coming into the treatment process from our use and our home product use. So from just residential consumers, and then the industry, and then we know from, you know, landfills, and then from use of aqueous film forming foams, which still currently contain PFAS for putting out hydrocarbon fires effectively. They come into the plant, you know, so the plant's just a receiver of all these things. And then through that normal process that tries to get rid of certain things that are regulated as far as getting discharged in the effluent, you end up having a water stream and a solid stream, to put it simple, right? And the thing with PFAS is, we already said, some of them can break down, but they break down to things that don't break down. So really what's going to happen to a PFAS when it comes into the plant is pretty much primarily two things, maybe a little bit of a third thing. It's going to end up in the sludge, you know, the solid residuals, or it's going to end up being discharged in the effluent. And it's possible for open lagoon systems and open digesters, you might be losing a very small fraction, I would guess, that might be volatile and transferred into the air. And those are, you have some volatile intermediates in that degradation process. But, you know, so that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the plant's going to do nothing to change the total load of PFAS, only to change the form and where it's located.
Is there any preference on the part of PFAS on it going into the water or the solids, or is it kind of end up being an equal split?
They're very interesting. So even though they are pretty water soluble on a relative scale, as we said, they also bioaccumulate in humans, and they also do sorb a lot to solids. So what happens is, you know, you get much lower concentrations in that water. It's much larger volume, right? So almost like a dilution effect too. And obviously getting discharged into rivers, which then is a problem because people are concerned about if that's a drinking water source. And then if not, is there enough there? It's bioaccumulating in fish and wildlife that people will eat, right? Mm-hmm. Then the sludge, it would seem like, oh, okay, if most of it goes to the sludge, then we can just deal with that. But that's not such an easy answer.
Sure.
Because right now the problem with the biosolids that's produced from these sludges is they have really high nutrient value, high carbon value. They've been land applied for, you know, decades. it's been a good use of a residual from wastewater treatment plants. But now, you know, they've been used without us realizing about these forever chemicals. So now we have to deal with that. So we already have lots of sites that have already been land applied numerous, you know, for decades. So now we have to go and investigate that. How much do we, you know, how much is the land applied biosolids contributing to our total load of PFASs in our drinking water, in our food system? And it would be easy to say, oh, well, you got those solids, send them to a landfill, incinerate them. It is not that simple, right? It's a municipality. It's our waste as municipal, you know, as citizens, and we're not prepared, really. None of these facilities are prepared to just take all these wastes and do something with them. And then if you're on the climate change world, you should be asking, wow, now we, who's going to, how are we going to sequester carbon? You're just burning it all up, or you're sending it to a landfill. So it's not an easy solution. You know, precautionary principle works to an extent. I feel like it can be cause an over-conservative response to how we deal with these solids that come from our own waste being treated in our own, you know, municipal wastewater treatment plants.
From everything you've seen, I'm curious, you know, how much of the biosolids out there might be a concern when it comes to PFAS?
Well, I think it's probably safe to say that all biosolids are going to have PFAS if they're getting anything from residential homes because of the products we talked about that all contain PFAS. But I think it's important to realize that I suspect that at least 95% of the biosolids that get produced by municipal plants have what I would call relatively low PFAS loads that when they're land applied, they're not necessarily going to lead to significant contributions above whatever ends up being our regulatory guidelines in our water source. It's really that 5% that has contributions from aqueous film forming foam use in the area, has industrial input, and has input from landfills. And different kinds of landfills will have different levels of PFAS loads. But then the rest of them, I want to say that are probably going to be relatively low, definitely lower. And how low is low enough? That part we still don't know. And so I'm interested in looking at that. And that's one of the research areas that I'm trying to focus on, is really what's happening in, you know, in the agricultural operations on everyday basis, because I live in Indiana.
So. Well, I live in Wilmington, North Carolina, where we have had Gen X in the Cape Fear River for about 40 years. And that was discovered a couple years ago. So it's of great interest around here as well.
Yes.
Circle back to the biosolids in a second. But before that happens, do we know about ways to remove PFAS during water treatment? What's actually effective?
Yeah. So for water treatment, I mean, pretty much what everybody's using, because it's acceptable, even though it's not adequate from a sustainability perspective in terms of long term, is activated carbon or some type of sorbent to try to capture the PFASs and clean up water for drinking water purposes. We know that it can do, it can take care of a lot of the problem, but we talked about the longer chains and the shorter chains. And now that a lot of the alternatives are going from longer to shorter, there's a lot more smaller molecules, which don't get captured for very long in these sorbent type systems. But, you know, the last few years, and so I think we're going to see a lot of things come out in the next couple years. People have been trying to work really hard at finding ways to mitigate, clean up water, and reduce the presence of these compounds. And we can talk about that a little more.
Sure.
But to answer the current question, really most plants, the best they're doing is sorption onto activated carbon. The other processes that might be used at some of the more advanced plants, those, you know, oxidation processes and things, those don't really help with these PFASs. They're just not adequate to break down these compounds.
What about reverse osmosis?
Yeah, so reverse osmosis works great for the drinking water end. The problem is you end up with a retentate or a lot of water that is your wastes from mm-hmm. that liquid wastes, and they're now more concentrated in PFASs because so you still have the problem. So it, no matter what right now, and this is probably going to be true for addressing a lot of issues, we're going to have what we tend to call treatment train. It's never going to be one process. So if one process can give you drinking water and then consolidate the waste into a smaller volume, which kind of happens when you run it through a granulated activated carbon sorbent type cartridge, you know, you put through a lot of water and so you've got rid of a large volume of waste, but now you have a concentrated waste and we have to deal with that, whether it's in the solid form or in the case of reverse osmosis in a liquid form, we have to deal with that. A lot of times these things go right back into the plant. So you're only recycling. So probably, again, and there's researchers working on this all over the world, actually, you know, can we address the retentate? Can we just deal with that stuff that comes off the reverse osmosis system, treat that so we don't put the PFASs back in the system, right? Mm. And so that would be potentially a much lower volume that you could treat, because a lot of the more innovative technologies that are, you know, more energy intensive and higher cost, but at this point worth it for this compound class. It's all, you know, a balance of scale. They couldn't deal with, they're not ready for prime time yet because they still have to deal with all these, this matrix that's not just water. A lot of studies start out looking at, well, what can we break down in clean water? Clean except for the contaminants, right? Now you have all these other things present in wastewater. And then, so if they can attack that, then we don't put it back in. So that can totally reduce, because there is chemical ways, but they're very advanced processes of breaking these compounds down. And we're still trying to understand which ones can break them down all the way, you know, and not have some in-between compound that we totally don't know anything about. So, I mean, there's a lot of promise. It's just right now I know it's challenging for everybody.
Sure.
You know.
Sure. Then going back to, thank you for letting me divert you a little here, back to the treatment, and then let's go back to biosolids. I think your piece, your study that was in the Water Environment Research Journal dealt with looking at biosolids and how the effectiveness or what happened to PFAS during some of the process. Could you explain what was published?
Yeah. So what we were looking at there, and that was just, you know, a little piece of the work we've been doing. Mm-hmm. We knew in looking, our initial goal was to look at what kind of PFAS loads we saw in commercial biosolids that are sold primarily in the store, but sometimes from the plant or just locally. And in the process, in interacting with some of the companies, they were interested in cooperating to see if their treatment process, you know, reduced the PFAS loads. So we thought, well, that'll be good to look at. And when we were looking at PFASs, we were really looking at the subset that has most of the attention, which we call, you know, the acid form, that's these terminal products from this biological degradation that we talked about. And that, you know, that list is growing, that what people were looking at. But at that time, looking at those 17 PFAS just in that little subfamily, two subfamilies. And so we found that really none of the processes other than dilution reduce the PFAS load in the biosolid material. And by dilution, I mean that if you mixed it with some other type of material that you might be composting with, you know, whether it's, you know, shells from some, you know, nut shells or coconut fibers or whatever you wanted to mix it with, that had anything that you're mixing it with that has a very low to negligible PFAS load is going to dilute your overall load. And then when it comes to biosolids, you're always thinking about, well, I want to, obviously it is a waste management strategy, but it also is, you know, an amazing nutrient reservoir, because you ask people, I'll say, well, what did it do to your plants? I said, oh, well, if you're just going to judge what did it do to your plants, here, look at these, which plants would you want to buy? You're going to buy the one, whether you know what they're grown in, you're going to buy the ones grown in biosolids, because they're going to grow faster. They look healthier because you've got slow carbon source release, slow nitrogen resource, other nutrients there. I said that, yeah. So when you're looking at land application of biosolids, I'm waiting to hear back on a paper I have submitted to ESNT, but I was trying to bring out the perspective. You have a PFAS load, but you have a nutrient load. And if you apply your biosolids based on nutrients and your material has a really low nutrient load, then you might end up applying a lot more biosolids and end up with, you know, much higher PFAS load. Mm. You know, so that right away tells you, oh, well, maybe I can apply less biosolids so that they really don't, you know, significantly impact anything, which means I might need to add some, you know, other sources of nitrogen so that I have, you know, both the nutrient, the carbon, and low chemical load that I don't want to apply. That's what we found, just basically dilution is all that worked for the few that we looked at. You know, we looked at some couple thermohydrolysis processes. We didn't do them ourselves. The plants were doing them. I've seen some early work that suggests that there's other thermohydrolysis products, at least for liquids, that might actually break these down. But I think a lot of that has to do with temperature as well. You know, higher temperatures, you know, you're gonna attack more of the PFAS molecules than lower temperature.
I appreciate the points you've made about biosolids as a resource and the idea that for decades, these have not been viewed as a waste. You know, it's part of this resource recovery, circular economy type of model where you have something that's incredible for soil health and for fertilizer on farms and for carbon sequestration. And there's kind of reclaiming help where there's been forest fires or when there's been damage from mining. So biosolids have this great host of benefits that makes it a shame to suggest just incinerating them all. And so this is kind of, I think, what, you know, the sector is trying to work through. And I'm very curious. I've been following this and there's all this speculation about, well, what happens when those biosolids are put on agricultural land and what happens? How much does the PFAS get in the soil? How much does it get in groundwater? Is it taken up by crops? So I'm very curious what we do know about that science. What is speculation? What gaps we need to fill kind of on that front there?
Obviously, we talked about them being forever chemicals. So when they get land applied, they're not going to just go away. So what can happen to them? Obviously, some of the ones that are smaller can, you know, tend to mobilize, and they're going to mobilize at different rates because they have different interactions with the soil. And as we talked about, we think that they might actually stay in the profile much longer because of additional retention mechanisms at the air-water interface. And so we expect, you know, kind of our shorter chains to move further down through the profile, our longer chains to take longer to move down. So that's one thing that'll happen. And then, as we said, that some of these larger PFAS that we call precursors, a lot of them are still not well identified. They are going to all, depending on their size and constituents, they're going to degrade slowly over time. And so in a way, that's kind of good. I mean, they're forever providing more of these ones that mobilize, but maybe at a very slow release rate. But that's happening. We know, general from the early research I did that I told you about, we know that the larger ones, we talk about side chain polymers. That's where you have like a non-perfluorinated backbone with all these chains of these PFASs hanging off. They can be cleaved from that backbone, but it appears to be a very slow process. So that means it's a long-term source, but potentially releasing things slow enough that, you know, typical good response from an engineer, dilution is the solution. Sometimes that's true. Mm-hmm. So that's going to happen. Then crop uptake, again, the ones that are going to tend to be more in the water, they're the ones that you're going to see taken up by the crops. So again, it's going to be more of your shorter chains that that work to date suggest that much higher concentrations of those are required to cause an adverse effect. Adverse health effect, and also they're not going to accumulate in the body as much. That's another challenge with the PFASs and the ones that originally were on everybody's radar because they have very long half-lives in our body, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. So these shorter chains don't have these long half-lives. They're excreted by the body faster. So we see that, and I think that most of the studies we are right in the middle of a literature review, and there's some other ones out there, but most of the PFAS studies are on, you know, hydroponics or spike systems rather than, you know, true field scenarios where you're applying, you know, a residual. So that's one of the data gaps that really, you know, get a better handle on things. And then the next step is, you know, where is the PFAS going? And so is that a crop that is going to be in direct consumption to a human? And right now, I feel like our consumption through that pathway is relatively low. That's my current assessment. But then you can have, you know, if you're growing, you know, switchgrass or whatever, and it's going to a dairy, how much of that accumulates, you know, in the cow and ends up in the milk. So there's some things that we're getting closer to understanding, you know, how much would have to be in that material, and how much would the cow have to eat before we'd actually see anything or be of concern. So those are things that people are working on. Yeah. So, and then the last, there could be some that, especially in effluent irrigation, or if you were using that type of waste from the water recoveries, you know, you might get some volatilization into the air. But most of it would be really sitting somewhere in the soil profile until it hit groundwater, or in the case of the Midwest, got discharged in a tile drain. And it's not, you know, there's also not a lot of data on if that's going to be a fast plug. Because what we see from pesticides and even hormones that are present in like manures, we would see kind of immediate responses to hydrologic events where a chemical would get discharged right into a tile drain and kind of act like it never saw the soil profile in between. I don't think we understand that for chemicals and biosolids as much, and especially not PFASs in land applied biosolids. So I think that's a data gap as well.
On the bigger picture, which all of your points have kind of made me think of, is that there's all this attention on water and PFAS, biosolids and PFAS. And sometimes I think the context is lost of how much the average person is exposed to PFAS from regular consumer goods and household dust and all these other places versus, you know, how much they may be getting exposed to from the water, except for if they're in one of these hot spots, if you will. Yeah.
Yeah. You brought up two important points. One, the fact that most consumers don't realize how much PFAS is in their everyday products and, you know, in their environment. People don't realize that PFASs are even in cosmetics, you know, and they're just all the way from cosmetics to carpets, to clothing, to things you use in the kitchen. You know, if you have things that are stain resistant, water resistant, they slide around really nice, you know, bathing suits, those all have PFAS. You know, you don't even think about Olympic swimmers. That's a huge benefit to them having PFAS in their swimwear, because it helps them go faster and cuts off seconds from their time, right?
Yeah.
And so now when manufacturers are trying to say, oh, what do? We want to be good stewards, but, you know, we don't want to penalize the swimmers that agreed to wear our suits versus another company in another country with their swimmers. So it's very complicated, right?
Yeah.
So we get a lot from that. We get a lot from our cars and our homes environment. Then you ask, well, then how much do we really get from our water? Well, this is where the tricky part comes in. And while there's so many different regulatory guidelines out there by different states and different countries, because they're all using, you know, similar approaches to how they estimate what's okay to be in the water for someone's daily load or lifetime load. Mm-hmm. They're trying to do due diligence. The problem is there's assumptions that go into that model, you know, whichever version they're using. And one is, well, what is actually causing a toxic effect? Okay, so that's always hard because we have to extrapolate a lot of times from general epidemiology studies or animal studies. So that's hard. The second part is that a lot of times most of them assume that 80% of your PFAS load, they cannot control through water because it comes from your home and office environment. So they can only control 20%. And so then because only 20% can get controlled by regulations to drinking water, that ends up causing that drinking water load to be very low. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The second thing, we know that drinking water, you know, that's a direct consumer, direct into the body, probably not a lot of attenuation. It just is going right in there. So both of those factors then contribute to these really low guidelines that were being given at the low parts per trillion level. So I think the consumer the public, all of us need to realize, I always say, don't freak out, because you've been living with these for a long time in your home, in your office, in your car, you know, so it's difficult. So
yeah,
I don't know if I answered your question, except to say that we have to be kind of even keeled, move slowly so that we don't cause an unintentional problem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we cause other chemicals to get produced quickly. They don't really, we don't know a lot about them. They get approved for use and then they end up being a problem. So I just think, you know, we just need to hard in the right directions.
Yeah. Put the science first, you know, focus on the science and be even keeled. I like that. And, you know, one of the other reasons I wanted to talk to you is because I saw you quoted in an article in the Boston Globe that, you know, kind of looked at things with a bit of the, I don't know if hysteria is the right word, but a bit of the, you know, freaking out, like you said, and you kind of had some comments there that I thought were the right tone with how PFAS should be approached, and being aware of the big picture, following the science, and all that. So this was very, very informative for me. I'm sure it will be for our listeners. And I really greatly appreciate your time, and we'll certainly keep following your work. So thank you so much, Linda.
Thanks, Travis. Have a good day.
Words on Water.